Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Science Studio. Keith Pannell here with Russ Chinelli in the studio. And today we're going to be talking to a very eminent geologist, someone who sort of made a career out of seismology. Russ, who's our guest today?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Professor Aaron Velasco, who is a professor in geology and also now acting interim associate dean in the College of Science. Yes. Welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, Aaron, I've known you for all the time that you've been at this university, and you've always been one of those people that's always ready to talk about what you do, and, you know, you mentor students. You're doing so many different things, and we'll just try to pick out a couple today. But before we get into any of that, we'd like the audience to know a little bit about Aaron, the young man, the young boy. How did you get into a career in science in the very first place?
I think my interest in science really stemmed from – actually, I wanted to be an engineer in high school. And it was actually driven by I wanted to be an aerospace engineer. And me and my brother were really avid space fans. And so we would get up in the middle of the night sometimes to see a launch. That's how we're kind of
– Which ones do you remember?
You know, I don't remember the Apollo. That was a little too young for that.
Okay,
there were some other launches.
The Challenger or something?
Yes, absolutely. I was a young adult at that particular time. And that left a major impression. But it drove sort of my interest in trying to – go to space. That was really what I started with, especially in high school. And then I went to UCLA as an undergraduate and discovered, I don't know, lots of different things. I liked to be outdoors, and I was good at math and physics, and so I decided to cross the two, and I came up with geophysics.
There's a book recently written, and I can't remember the name of it or the author, but the point of the book is that the space program in those days invigorated many people to study science and engineering. It has to be recognized it was very important to people like you.
Absolutely. I don't know if I would have gotten into science if it hadn't been for that.
Yeah, but I mean, the point there, it was the beginning of something that no one had ever done. Right. Now, in a sense, the space program is 50 years old. I don't know what it is, but it's quite old. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, now that sort of novelty has worn off. And
no,
so
I don't think so. I disagree with that completely.
No?
Do you realize that the first man-made object has just left our solar system?
Yeah.
It took it 35 years to get from Earth going out.
Well, that's probably why people are thinking, well, that's not a career for me, because if I've got to go and explore the universe 35 years before I get outside
but
of the
it's not, it's
current
not
area.
The point is that it excited people.
I don't think it's past.
It still excites me.
Well, I actually think it still excites people, especially here in El Paso. And a great example of that is Dr. Danny Olivas.
All right.
And in my role as president of the Board of Insights, we had a Space Science Day over the summer that featured him. And we had 1,300 people show up for that.
Oh, there's no doubt. You meet an astronaut and you never forget it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's get into this business of seismology. Again, for the audience, there's always new people that don't remember the last time we talked about seismology. What is the science of seismology?
It's really the science behind earthquakes and any motion that's created by man that can generate ground motion. And so I had a long career actually studying nuclear weapons, bombs. And before I came to UTEP, I was actually worked for a company, and I worked for Los Alamos National Lab, trying to improve our ability to detect nuclear explosions in the noise of earthquakes. But here, my role is to study earthquakes.
Which we can do now, right?
We've had the ability to do it for many years. The challenge is that the context has changed. It used to be the Soviet Union, China, France, and the United States as being the big nuclear powers, the UK also. And it was very focused on, you know, specific sites.
Places, yeah.
And now it's the context has completely changed.
So are you telling me that, for example, if we worry about Tehran, that the seismology there would be different, harder to detect?
In the context, yes, that's exactly right. And because the bombs aren't as big and they're in areas that we've never really seen.
We don't know enough about,
right.
Maybe.
And the Earth is very complex. And so when you're looking at waves that travel and bounce around the Earth, they get more complex the closer in you get, believe it or not.
Well, that is interesting because, I mean, that you read about people being able to detect earthquakes in but your point there is that the earthquakes usually come from zones which have been well studied because they're on this ring of fire, for example.
Right.
But they can choose an area of little low activity or little study to do their nuclear explosions.
Absolutely.
And so, I hadn't even thought of that.
It's a little bit like finding a needle in a haystack. And so there's a lot of effort. And
that's not so comforting, actually, because I would have thought – If somebody had come up to me in the street and said, Dr. Fennell, you know, is it true that we can detect, you know, nuclear explosion from Iran without any doubt really immediately, I'd have said yes, but I'd be wrong.
Well, it actually depends on the size. So 1 kiloton, we think we can detect.
Do you know Vipin Gupta by any way, who visits us often? He's from Sandia. But his thesis, he's a physicist, was reporting the first nuclear test in China.
Well, yeah, if you have underground nuclear tests, the only way to really truly detect it is through seismology. If there's a leakage of radiation, that's the smoking gun, though. That basically tells you if you get radionuclide detection.
So, but if they're above the ground, they're obvious, I guess.
Yes, they're obvious, yeah. And in places are monitored well enough to know whether someone did something in the atmosphere.
But anyway, so, I mean, that's something that you used to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
Working in the Los Alamos area. Yeah. And then you became a faculty member down here.
Yes.
And so how did you decide how to apply your knowledge in seismology? What were the things that really excited you that had nothing to do with nuclear explosions?
When I did my dissertation, at UC Santa Cruz. And believe it or not, there was an earthquake in 1989. I was a first-year graduate student, just completed my first year. And talk about on-the-job training. It was pretty exciting in some respects and also very scary. And whenever you go through an event, we were 5 miles from the epicenter, the campus itself was. And so the shaking was very violent, and it continued on with a series of aftershocks.
Yeah, I experienced an aftershock in 1990 early.
Yeah, and that event occurred during the Bay Area World Series. If you're a baseball fan,
yes,
you would know
right,
that.
Oh, yes, that's right, I
remember. It was between the A's and the Giants, and it occurred right before the game. You know, actually, believe it or not, baseball saved lives that day.
Yes.
And the reason why is because people were not on the freeways when it was a 5 o'clock game. It was an early game. So people had gotten home early, so there was not a lot of traffic on the roads, which actually saved a lot of people's lives because there were some freeway structures that collapsed in Oakland, for example. And they,
yeah. So maybe I've seen this on the television then, that, you know, you're just going along and then there's the bridge ceases to exist.
Yes.
And cars went over. I mean, yeah. Incredible.
It was a pancake, actually, Case.
Okay,
and they originally estimated 300 people on that structure, and it turned out to be like 60 people mm-hmm. who lost their lives. And it's really true. Baseball really did save lives that day.
And that was your introduction to graduate school.
That was sort of my introduction to studying large earthquakes, too. And I started studying large earthquakes in my dissertation. And we just know so little about earthquakes in many respects. And the more I study earthquakes, the more you realize that each one is different in its own way. And so when I came back here, I started studying large earthquakes again. But there was an event that happened in Alaska. And the reason why no one really knows about it, because it didn't rupture the pipeline. This is an earthquake that happened in 2000, I think it was 2001. Pretty large earthquake. It was a Denali Fault earthquake. Mm-hmm. But what made that earthquake unusual, first of all, that the pipeline didn't bust and it went right under the pipeline. And they had designed it to
resist.
Actually put it on sliders over that fault. And it didn't rupture. So it could have been one of the worst natural man-made disasters, but it wasn't. But the earthquake did something really funny. It created waves that traveled to the lower 48 and triggered a bunch of earthquakes. And we had never really seen such a widespread sort of like elevated, we call it seismicity, in this region. And what did it was actually what was called the surface waves, the energy that's trapped along the surface of the earth. And that's what my dissertation was actually on, that particular wave. It's the wave that does the damage during an earthquake. But these waves travel around the world. It's like a ringing when an earthquake, a large earthquake happens.
I mean, one's familiar, as you pointed out, with the word of aftershock. But that's a different thing from the generation of new earthquakes in other regions.
Thousands of kilometers away.
Yeah, right. The aftershock should be basically localized where the initial incident was.
Absolutely.
But you're talking about sort of spawning daughters and granddaughters thousands of miles away.
Yes.
And that's not common.
Well, that was uncommon at the time, and no one really fully recognized that. And that led a whole new area of research where this is sort of where I've been leading the last several years. And there was a paper that came out in Nature earlier this month that talked about an earthquake that generated pretty large events. But I had a paper in 2008 that kind of showed that this happens a lot more often than we normally did. And I did a whole global survey of 15 earthquakes and looked at thousands of waveforms, and that's basically the recordings, and look for these events. And we found quite a few.
So you needed to be able to pinpoint not only temporarily, but I mean in terms of time, but also with the shock waves on the surface, that you could pinpoint that definitely these others were associated with the primary incident.
What about that big one in Mexico City? I remember watching the destruction and body parts in the stadium. Oh, my gosh, and people I knew there. Was that a normal earthquake?
Mexico City was unusual in the sense that the bulk of the damage was 300 kilometers away from where the earthquake occurred. And the reason why Mexico City suffered so much had to do more with the construction and the materials things were built on than the earthquake itself. And I think that was a – if you're familiar with Mexico City, it's built on a lake bed.
Yeah.
And so the soils are very soft. And when you build a structure on soft soil, you shake it, the soil actually turns to liquid.
Yeah,
it's called liquefaction. And anything built on that is going to collapse.
Yeah.
So in fact then, I mean, you were talking about the pipeline being on these little sort of runners, as you put it.
Right.
And California has tremendous building codes, as do a lot of other places around the world. But that wouldn't be able to apply in Mexico City because of this sort of subsoil.
But I think what's really interesting now is that now we fully recognize there's a link between earthquakes. The study
So if one occurs in Mexico and Chile and then Mexico coming up the coast?
Okay, so this is where the controversy is. We showed in 2008 was basically that these surface waves from these large earthquakes can trigger small earthquakes around the world. But we had no indication that they trigger large earthquakes. And so that's with our premise. And we don't know why that happens. Like, why is it that these large earthquakes are being triggered? There was a study that just came out in Nature. There was a couple of very large earthquakes that happened in the ocean off of Sumatra. And they generated these very large surface waves for various reasons. And they seemed, in the study, was trying to show that it seemed to trigger earthquakes within days of that event, fairly large earthquakes up to magnitude 6.5. So that's an unusual sort of study.
We have to take a break. You're listening to Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell with Russ Chianelli and Aaron Velasco from the Geological Sciences Department at UT El Paso. And we'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. David Neisel.
And I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog. Increasingly, the mind-blowing technology portrayed in science fiction movies is made real in labs around the world.
In particular, two recently published studies have the feel of Star Wars. The first is viruses engineered to generate electricity. One day they may power nanoscale implanted devices in the human body.
The viruses used in these studies attack bacterial cells. They're simple organisms with proteins and a genome. In one particular virus, the proteins have two distinct ends, one with a positive charge and the other with a negative.
This arrangement of opposing charges at opposite ends of the same molecule can create a piezoelectric effect. It means when the shape of these molecules are compressed, they generate an electric current.
Researchers used the concept to build tiny biogenerators that could be activated by a person's movements, such as stair climbing. They may one day power implanted devices that sense and report on the levels of important compounds like glucose or neurotransmitters.
Another amazing technology is the biological ion transistor computer chip, the first ever produced. In these biological transistors, charged molecules called ions take the place of electrons. In essence, this means a computer chip can now network with human cells.
In recent experiments, researchers used a powerful neurotransmitter called acetylcholine as the charged molecule. When a message from the brain travels along nerves to a muscle, a neuron transmits acetylcholine ion to nearby muscle cells and triggers movement.
In the future, this could allow fine control of muscle movement, or more importantly, restore movement in people with paralysis.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries are shaping the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Aaron Velasco from the Geological Sciences Department at UT El Paso. And we've been talking or listening to Aaron talk about this whole concept that, you know, big earthquake in Alaska and hey presto, There's little ones all around, maybe in Ohio, maybe in El Paso, maybe in California, by the surface waves that are going through. And this is a pretty new concept when you first came across it. Is it now generally recognized, Aaron, then, that this is to be expected most of the time?
I think so. I think their community would say that. And I was just recently quoted in USA Today about this article in Nature. And what I said was, you know, had we said this 10 years ago, I think we might have been laughed at by our community. But I think the scientific evidence is just overwhelming now. And I think a lot of people are jumping on board and studying all these different impacts. Because we don't it highlights a lot of different things. One of them is that we don't even know the absolute stresses you need to trigger an earthquake. We don't understand that. I mean, that's just a fundamental observation that we don't have. This might allow us to do that, to understand that process a little bit better.
I mean, one of the things I always thought was, okay, if there's an earthquake in Sumatra, some of the pressure is relieved or the tension, and then so it's going to put more stress further up. Looking at them over the years, it looks like they move around because of one here and then further north.
That's a great observation. There are actually two different types of triggering now that we understand. One of them is called static, and that means that if an earthquake happens in one specific region, it likely increases right adjacent to it. Because of the ground motion itself, yeah. And that's called static. The stuff I'm talking about is stuff that's remote. It's called dynamic because it's due to the dynamic waves that come through. And so the dynamic triggering could occur all around the globe. The static occurs usually within a couple of fault lanes of a fault.
Are the secondary, the daughter, if you like, earthquakes always smaller than the initial one? I mean, can you generate from the earthquake in Alaska a bigger one somewhere else by the surface wave?
We don't think so.
Okay.
This is where we have no evidence for that. And we actually did a study, me and a colleague at the United States Geological Survey, to show that we don't think that really happens.
Okay.
The reason why this Nature paper created a lot of interest is because they're showing that, well, it didn't happen directly with the surface wave, but there seems to be increase of larger events after, days after this other surface waves. And it's a very hard thing to prove statistically.
Oh, it is.
It is. It's very hard. And this is why.
So when you first published this, did you get a lot of critiques from referees?
No, because what I took a different approach in that I looked at thousands of waveforms. And that's the only way I could prove that statistically this is way beyond, without a doubt, that this happens. And when I first started studying this, if you find one event, it's very hard to say, well, this could have been a random thing, process. But if you study a series, look at, again, thousands of waveforms, you can show statistically that this happens without a doubt.
So then that leads to the next point. I mean, if you say, can you predict where they're going to happen? In the sense that, I mean, I think of these waves, shock waves going through the surface, coming down little areas like freeways, or is it pretty much in every direction equally? I mean, are there special pathways where the energy can be channeled and therefore you say, hey, straight down to the El Paso Rio Grande Rift Valley?
It's a great question, and the answer is yes and no. Part of when an earthquake happens is that it radiates these surface waves in different directions just by how it moves. So there'll be some, we call it azimuth, some direction at which the amplitude is increased and other directions where it's almost zero. And that's just the nature of earthquakes themselves and how they generate surface waves. So the answer is yes, in some directions, absolutely you'll see, you know, increased amplitudes and increased seismicity. Other directions, you won't. And that's a function of the amplitude of the wave that comes out. It's a function of how it actually occurs.
And so you would never be able to make an a priori prediction. Like if there's another earthquake in Santa Cruz area or San Francisco, each earthquake, as you said at the beginning, is distinctive. And therefore, the increased amplitude would be in different directions, though they could be in almost the same place.
Yeah, there's another effect that I didn't even mention. What happened in Alaska was actually something I wrote a paper on, that particular earthquake, because I thought the surface waves were fascinating. Because what happened was that the amplitudes, it was a 7.9 earthquake, but when you look at the amplitude of the waves in the United States, it was about a magnitude 9 from the surface waves. That's what you would estimate, because the amplitudes were increased because of two reasons. One of them was because of that azimuthal pattern that I just talked about, and the other one was something we called directivity, or the Doppler shift. And so what happened was that the earthquake started at one point, ripped down the fault, but it ripped towards the lower 48. And when it ripped to the 48, it increased the amplitudes of those surface waves by 100 times. And so that's why it looked like a magnitude 9 in this direction. And so that's an effect we cannot predict. We cannot predict that.
Why is it that a little one doesn't become a big one? I mean, do we know that?
Yeah, it's math. If you imagine that a magnitude 4 to 5, magnitude is an arbitrary scale. We like to use better energy, and moment is the way we do this. But since magnitude is sort of like what people can relate to, we still use magnitude. We prefer to use energy. But if you take a 3 to 4, it's a 32 times difference in energy release, or 4 to 5 is the same sort of thing. So you could imagine that you would need 32 threes to match a 4. So, you know, you need 32 sevens to match an 8. And we just don't see that happening. And so that's the thing, is that when you look at relieving stress, it just doesn't happen that way.
Well, here's another thing that I was reading about recently, that the Earth moves through its cycles. You know, at some point it's closer to the sun. The whole solar system is moving through, you know. And there was some article I read about how the gravitational changes as we move can also affect the earthquakes.
There's been studies that try to show that tidal effects. It hasn't been shown conclusively. I think people have proposed that. And, you know, there's also other interesting ideas that the dam that was built, a very large dam in China, contributed to an earthquake. These are very hard things to prove because you need large amounts of data to show.
So, but go back to this dam then. The idea there is building up that great pressure on the land by having the water, or by having no water further down. I mean, what's the trigger that they were thinking?
The trigger would be, so this is why it's probably not really realistic. Most earthquakes occur between 5 kilometers, 3 kilometers, or about the shallowest they occur. The idea is that the water penetrates down, and water weakens faults.
Yes.
And so that would potentially trigger an earthquake. But this earthquake started 18 kilometers down. So
that's
to get water that deep, we don't have any evidence that that happens. But it's not saying
that we
don't.
But what about the pressure, though? That's what I remember reading. Okay, all of a sudden you got this big weight of water and something not here, so the dynamics of the pressure
changed. Again, it has to do with where earthquakes are generated. They're just deeper. And so by the time you get that as deep as what they start, that pressure is actually very, very small. The lithostatic pressure alone is much greater.
Okay, what about this idea of lubricating the faults?
Well, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, that to relieve the stress you would accumulate in an 8, you need 32 magnitude 7s. That's a very hard thing to do. You're messing with Mother Nature, and we don't even understand this process very well. So it'd be very hard to systematically do this so that you can.
I mean, do we understand with a common rock, granite or something, if two pieces are together under pressure, do we understand the stress?
Absolutely. I mean, there's been lots of experiments. This is how we know, you know. But when you actually have an observation at depth, there's only one point that's been drilled into the San Andreas Fault. One. And it lasted 3 hours.
Your sort of career seems to me, I had a professor of geology, Dunham, in the University of Durham. I took geology at college. And every time there was a volcano, he'd bugger off. He'd be gone. You know, we wouldn't see him for a week. And then he'd come back, and his first lecture was nothing but photographs from various aeroplanes of the volcano. I mean, it was a wonderful career. Are you an earthquake chaser in that sense?
I am at times. And sometimes I went out and I was asked by a national organization to go assist with an aftershock deployment after the Chile earthquake in 2010. And I welcome that sort
but
of invitation.
Is the field really divided that much? Okay, I'm a volcanologist. I don't have anything to do with earthquakes, and I'm an earthquake person. I don't care about volcanoes.
It's not really about caring, but again, you're called upon your expertise to help. And I've done aftershock deployments before.
So what do you mean by aftershock deployment? Predicting where they're going to be, or what's the terminology mean?
Basically going in after.
Looking at the results?
Well, no. What we do is we actually put out instruments to try to locate the aftershocks, because the aftershocks give you an idea where the fault really occurred.
Okay.
And so some areas you just don't have a lot of seismic sensors, and so you need to go down there and put sensors down there. Chile was a huge earthquake. It was an 8.8, very long fault. I drove, I think, 2,000 miles that trip just going and collecting data from stations that had been deployed.
And so, but the end result of that deployment down to look at this, gives what information? It allows you to pinpoint more closely the subterranean geology.
Yes.
Because it's not been an area that was well studied to begin with.
Right.
And that's some predictive value, hopefully, in the future.
Yeah, and in fact, it's an area that we didn't think that was going to have a magnitude 9.
Oh, oh.
And so, and essentially,
like us here.
And you know, now we've come to the understanding that the Pacific Northwest has a potential to have a magnitude 9. And maybe 30 years ago, we didn't even understand that. And so that tells you how we're in the infancy of being understand this process.
But it's really what the way you've described it is mapping the Earth at some level, that we don't know enough about the faults and the structures. And
yes. Yes, and I have another project that I work on that we're actually trying to develop 3D Earth models using not only seismic data but potential field data like gravity or magnetics and do a study of the 3D structure of the Earth. And, in fact, we're just about ready to publish a paper on the structure of this area.
A three-dimensional structure of underground.
Yes.
So you can see mountains under there and valleys. But, I mean, tell me what exactly does that mean? You've got 1 minute.
It's sort of like that. In fact, we live in the Rio Grande Rift. We actually live in the southern Rio Grande Rift. And it's controversial whether the rift is expanding or not and what's driving that process. When you think about rifts, rifts are areas that split the continent apart. And our fundamental idea is that, you know, that's due to a mantle upwelling, so the hot material is coming to the surface. That's not the case. The sun is not what we're showing for this particular rift. So there's another process at play that we don't fully understand.
Wonderful. We have to go. Aaron, it's, as always, great talking to you.
Thank you very much.
You're a great asset to this institution.
Our guest has been Professor Aaron Velasco here at the Geology Department at the University of Texas at El Paso. Aaron, thanks for being on Science Studio, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
Thank you very much.
And thanks all the listeners out there that tune in week after week, year after year. We love you and hope you'll be back next week. Bye-bye. Thank you.